Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 11th of April. This hour of the program, the president has delivered a budget to Congress, $3.8 trillion, and a lot of people aren't very happy. Advocates for seniors say the president is breaking his promise to protect Social Security. Conservatives are saying that he is breaking his promise not to raise taxes on the middle class. So another debate, of course, will ensue. By including proposals to trim Social Security and Medicare, which are the government's two biggest benefit programs, the president is hoping to entice Republicans to consider tax increases. He is saying, I have already met Republicans more than halfway, so in the coming days and weeks, I hope Republicans will come forward and demonstrate that they are really as serious about the deficit and debt as they claim to be. However, there are many Democrats who are saying that the AFL-CIO president, for example, calling the proposed deficit reductions wrong and indefensible. We have a lot to look at this hour. It's a complicated budget. It's not just those issues. There are others as well. There are calls for an increase in spending for infrastructure projects and some more money, scaling back farm subsidies and trimming federal retiree programs. And of course, the list goes on. We will have two guests with us. We do have two guests with us during the course of this hour to talk about the budget, and we'll be welcoming phone calls from you as we always do. Roy Myers is one of our guests. He is professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Professor Myers, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
My pleasure to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. And also, Stephen Dennis is with us. Stephen is White House correspondent for Congressional Quarterly. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
Well, the press reports seem to indicate that there are conservatives who aren't at all happy with this and a lot of progressive Democrats who aren't at all happy with this. Does that mean it's a good thing, Professor Myers?
Well, I suppose that depends in part on your political perspective. I do think that the president has taken a pretty brave stance in the sense that he is willing to go far away from his own policy preferences in hopes of getting a deal between the, particularly the Senate and the White House, in order to stop this endless period of sequesters, fiscal cliffs, debt ceilings, the frequent deadlines, and the very long impasse we've had between the parties.
Mm-hmm. He has said, Stephen, that he feels he's gone more than halfway to meet the Republicans' concerns. Would you agree with that assessment of this?
Well, I don't know what, you know, halfway to what. I mean, if you look at the two budget blueprints, you know, Paul Ryan's budget and Obama's budget over 10 years, they're very, very different. So is it halfway to Paul Ryan's budget? No. You know, Paul Ryan's budget in 2023, after they're fully phased in, spends $700 billion less in that year alone than the president's. Obama's budget taxes an additional $250 billion or so in that one year. So they're pretty darn far apart, and halfway to the Republicans, you know, maybe halfway to what John Boehner's, you know, offer was a couple of years ago when they were bargaining in, you know, the rooms in the White House together. But it's not really halfway to where the Republicans really want to go. But there is this, you know, the most controversial thing for the president here is trying to have a stingier measure of inflation. You know, that affects a lot of his base. But, you know, I think something that's not very well understood is that they are cushioning that blow by adding back a lot of money, tens of billions of dollars back, to make sure actually that poorer seniors will actually get higher Social Security payments than they would otherwise. Older seniors would get higher Social Security payments than they would otherwise. Poorer veterans would not see a cut. Means-tested programs, you know, for the poor would not see, would not be affected by the CPI the way that they are formulating it. And so the White House has not done a very good job of sort of explaining that to their base, but they're trying to. At the same time, they're saying, hey, we're reaching out to Republicans by putting some of these things that are tough for us on the table.
Mm-hmm. Professor Myers, what do you make of what Stephen just said?
Yes, I agree largely with what Steve said. I do think that actually some of the people on the left in his base are behind the design of what Obama has proposed on the chain CPI, particularly Bob Greenstein, who's probably the most respected budget analyst on the left, has argued that this is an acceptable compromise, particularly in comparison to some other proposed changes to Social Security, which would have much more serious and difficult consequences for the elderly, such as raising the full benefit retirement age. And he, Greenstein and others have been arguing that this would be an acceptable compromise if, for example, a supplemental security income would be exempt from this provision. In addition, as Steve mentioned, the fact that Social Security benefits would be improved for the very elderly, who would be most affected by the compounding effect of reducing the rate of growth in the COLAs, the cost of living adjustments, year after year after year. One other point about this is that the chain CPI would also apply to tax brackets, and it would have the effect of increasing tax yield almost about the same amount that would be cut from Social Security. So in that sense, it conforms with the president's balanced approach rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Can we look at just the broad area here of Social Security? There are many, and we've heard from them frequently on this show, who say that Social Security entitlement benefit programs simply are not sustainable. We've got all these baby boomers turning 65 by the second now in this country, and their medical prices are going up, so that eventually, in the not too distant future, maybe more so with Medicare than with Social Security, this is going to create huge problems for all domestic spending, and we simply are going to have to, and maybe now is the time, look seriously at these programs. Is there a good deal of truth in that, Stephen?
Oh, absolutely. And even in the president's budget, you know, chain CPI, you know, you're talking about a 10-year spending in his budget of about $46 trillion. Chain CPI really doesn't have any real impact until, you know, sort of years 8, 9, and 10 in this budget, after he's not even in office anymore, because it only affects, you know, a tenth or two, maybe a couple of tenths of a percent of your COLA each year, so the compounding effect doesn't really start until later on. And it already, the retirement of the baby boom generation over the next 10 years is crowding out the rest of the budget. The president's own budget sees domestic spending and defense spending going from about 8 or 9% of GDP to about 5%. I mean, that's a pretty big cut. Now, that's happening mainly because those, you know, defense and domestic spending are going to be growing very, very slowly and less than the rest of the economy, much less than the rest of the economy. But those other programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the Obamacare piece that's going into effect mostly next year, you know, those are all going to be growing as a percentage of the economy, and it's going to be accelerating even more in the next decade. You know, the chain CPI is, you know, the people like Greenstein, who are looking at these long-term numbers, and the CBO and others, and the budget hawks in both parties say, look, chain CPI is the easy one. This is the low-hanging fruit. And even with it, the Social Security long-term deficit would, you know, it closes about a quarter of it or less, and you'd still have three quarters more left to do, but this would be a start. And the Republicans really are demanding more. They don't think it's enough to just close one quarter of Social Security's future shortfalls. They want to see the president do more. They want a higher retirement age. They're not going to get that. And the question now is, whether the Republicans are going to come to the table and reciprocate with anything, but there's really no expectation of that. This is the same proposal that Obama offered in December, and John Boehner rejected. So it's not clear to me that Obama's going to get any more revenue out of the Republicans.
Maybe you just need, Professor Myers, a few more lovely dinners at the White House.
Well, I understand they didn't serve lobster Thermidor last night compared to the meeting that they had earlier at the Willard Hotel.
It was steak, though.
Steak.
Probably a pretty good one, huh?
Well, you know, to build on what Steve said, I think the problem that the country has in dealing with this long-term challenge is in part framing the issue as one of entitlements per se. Because, in fact, the different entitlement programs are really quite different, both in their projected growth rates and the policy choices that we need to make. And in particular, I think that Social Security, while, of course, it's still a daunting political problem, there are reasonable modifications to benefit levels and some small increases in taxes that could make that program sustainable over the long run. In great contrast, health spending is still the major challenge that we face, and not simply in terms of the federal budget, but in the entire economy, because our health spending is far higher than it is in other rich countries, and even though we spend more, we tend to have lower quality outcomes. And that rate of growth, although in the last couple of years it has moderated significantly, is still projected to lead towards very unsustainable problems, not just for the federal budget, but for private employers who are paying for their employees' health insurance. So if you look at the president's budget, it really hasn't received much attention yet. The emphasis has been on this heavy issue of the chain CPI, but there are certainly some proposals in the budget on building on this, as he puts it in the budget, building on savings in the health care law. And I think what we're going to be seeing year after year after year over the next decade is significant proposals to reduce spending in these programs and try and make the system much more efficient. That's going to be a very difficult challenge, but it's going to be central to putting the federal government's budget on a sustainable path.
I understand one of those items in the budget, which is worth, you know, doing another whole show on and discussing at some length, is negotiating better prescription drug prices.
Yes, correct. In fact, negotiation might be a kind word from the pharmaceutical producers. They feel like they're being told to issue their products at a much lower price and forced to give rebates. But there's also a provision here that would charge upper-income beneficiaries under Medicare's Part B and D, those with over, say, $170,000, I believe, income a year, higher income-related premiums. So, I mean, one might view that as kind of a quasi-tax increase, but it's viewed more as increased premium in this budget. So there are a lot of provisions in here that could be controversial. For example, the Affordable Care Act established an independent payment advisory board, but gave it relatively weak powers to reduce reimbursement rates for medical providers, doctors in particular, should Medicare spending grow at a faster rate than was targeted in the bill. And the president's budget is going to propose some increased powers make it more likely that this IPAB would be able to propose reimbursement rate cuts should growth cost growth be strong in the health budget.
Stephen, let's go to increase in taxes and how much the president depends on this to make the whole system work, and how he is likely to respond to Speaker Boehner's comment, the president got his tax hikes in January. We don't need to be raising taxes on the American people.
Well, I think the way to look at this budget, including the tax side of it, is what's sort of the real offer to the Republicans and what is sort of Obama's sort of wish list side of the budget. And there's basically stuff that, including that IPAB piece, that's not going to get through the Republican Congress in the House. It's just never going to happen. So there's a whole long list of the president's new programs, probably about 80 to 90% of what he's proposing as far as new things simply is just not going to happen barring some magical deal. And then there's this other piece, which is, can we get some kind of deficit reduction plan cobbled together? Now, the president proposed something on the order of $1.4 trillion in tax increases in this budget over 10 years. Mm-hmm. He gives back about $400 billion in new tax cuts. But sort of take that off the table, what is the real offer to Boehner? And that's about $680 billion. $100 billion from the inflation change and how that affects brackets, and that includes tax increases on people making under $250,000 because some of them would lose certain tax breaks. And also this $580 billion, which is tax increases on people making over $250,000 by squeezing their deductions. And so those are the main pieces that the president's really pushing for. He has all kinds of other provisions that he's trying to get through and has zero chance of getting through. There's a $60 billion bank fee he's been trying to get through since the financial crisis. That's not going to happen. There's another $78 billion in estate and gift taxes that's dead on arrival. Now, even the $680 billion that he wants as part of, the grand bargain, the Republicans have been saying that that's DOA last year and it's DOA now. But the president and all of his people are insisting that they are not going to do chain CPI for Social Security. They're not going to cut Medicare. They're not going to do anything the Republicans really want to do unless they come to the table with some additional tax revenue from wealthy people and corporations. So that, we're basically stuck here until one side blinks or we just muddle along. And mm-hmm. I think, the expectation right now on the Hill is we probably end up muddling along and maybe do some things on the side, like corporate tax reform or something else that doesn't require you to break that initial logjam that's been sort of, causing 2 years really of gridlock.
Yeah. What do you think, Professor Myers, of the plan for tax revenue, more tax revenue from wealthy people?
Well, I agree with Steve that muddling along is a pretty good projection of what's likely to happen. But I think the negotiation strategy that Obama is trying to use here is relatively unfamiliar, so we need to be careful about relying on just what's happened over the last couple of years as a prediction of what is absolutely going to happen this year. I mean, frankly, I think what he's trying to do is to cut a deal with enough Republican senators so he can place the House GOP in a very difficult position, in much the same way that he did around January on the fiscal cliff. And in fact, Boehner really, in effect, encouraged the Senate cut a deal so that the House, in some sense, would be forced to go along because they were in a difficult position with the public. So, in other words, he's made his... What he says is his final and best offer, and as Steve said, he's not going to accept chain CPI and the like unless he gets some tax increases.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so the question is it a credible position? Is he going to be able to get enough Republican senators to move with him in much the same way that we've seen some compromises in the last couple of weeks on immigration, and particularly gun control? I mean, the idea that you would see Senator Pat Toomey, a Republican conservative from Pennsylvania, cut a deal on gun control is pretty surprising to most people in Washington, but it has happened
mm-hmm.
on background checks. So, if you look at Obama's budget in terms of revenues as a percentage of GDP, it's actually not that different on its face than what the House GOP says it wants. It's a little more than 19% of GDP, and the House Republicans are a little below 19%. But the Tax Policy Center did a very important analysis of what was in the Ryan plan, consistent with what they've done in the last couple of years, where, in effect, the Ryan plan proposes significant cuts in marginal tax rates, and then says that the result of those tax cuts on the deficit will be offset by savings from simplifying the tax code by reducing or eliminating preferences, but they don't specify which preferences they might want to eliminate. Because after all, for example, if you tell Americans that they might be able to deduct less for their mortgage interest payments, many Americans wouldn't like that idea. So the Tax Policy Center said if you look at the projected revenue losses from cuts in marginal tax rates, that it would have to add up to $5.7 trillion. And to offset all those with, and by the way, those cuts in marginal tax rates tend to benefit the rich very substantially. I think most people that look at the House position on taxes believe that it's just not credible, either analytically or politically. So I can understand why Obama is trying this strategy of trying to get the Senate Republicans to, some Senate Republicans to go along with it in hopes of, again, forcing the House to, in a sense, back off and accept what some of their co-partisans in the Senate are willing to deal with Obama on.
Let's go to phone calls. Let's welcome phone calls first. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We're talking about the budget. The president gave it to Congress, $3.8 trillion. And the question is whether or not Republicans and Democrats will be able to get together and deal with tax increases and entitlement cuts, or if we're just going to muddle along, as our guests have suggested, on the same path we seem to have been on for the last couple of years. What are your thoughts about all of this? Here is our number again, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, if you'd like to go that route, is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and everything is wide open for you at this very moment. We have two guests with us this hour. Stephen Dennis is White House correspondent for Congressional Quarterly, and Roy Myers is professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History has designated this month, April, as Jazz Appreciation Month, and we're going to do just that. The second hour of our program today, our guest will be Bob Parlocha, American jazz expert, host of Jazz with Bob Parlocha, which is a nationally syndicated jazz show. And we'll also hear a lot of jazz. We're going to have some fun. Art Tatum, Dizzy Gillespie, Billie Holiday, Miles Davis, Dave Brubeck, John Coltrane, Charlie Parker, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald, and others. That's all coming up as we appreciate jazz, hour two of our show. All right, to your phone calls, our lines are now filled, but eventually you'll be able to get through, or you can always send an email if you'd like to do that. That is talk@WPR.org or The Kathleen Dunn Show, our Facebook page. 800-486-8655 is our number. Mark in Appleton, our first caller. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to suggest that the deficit, that the Republicans are not really interested in deficit reduction. The real goal is to reduce the size of government and limited government. And you see that from the tax cuts in 2001, 2002 that took a surplus and created a deficit. You see that today in Wisconsin, we had large cuts to balance the budget. And Governor Walker immediately suggests we need tax cuts, which will then recreate a structural deficit that we supposedly had to get rid of. And also just the comments about attacking Obama for wanting to cut Medicare, what Representative Walden said yesterday, kind of criticizing those cuts, when in fact the Republicans at the same time are suggesting basically getting rid of Medicare as we know it and turning it into an insurance program.
Professor, thank you very much, Mark, for the call. Professor Myers, would you like to start?
Yeah, I agree to some extent that that some Republicans do have their goal of cutting down government size. Although, of course, that has varied over the years. One of the reasons why the Tea Party became influential in this country is that some Republicans thought that the Republicans in Washington had lost their way by supporting earmarks in great magnitude and some of the other things they did.
Regarding the comment about Representative Walden's point, I think actually there was a significant change here in that he decided to try and repeat the strategy used by the Republicans in 2010 and 2012. That is, in Obamacare, the bill would, in fact, did significantly cut the reimbursement rates provided to Medicare Advantage plans, the HMO in Medicare. And the Republicans haven't been beaten up by the Democrats for decades for having proposed cuts to Medicare, decided to do the same thing to Democrats. And yet at the same time, if you look at Representative Ryan's budget, there are very significant cuts to Medicare, and particularly how it's converted to premium support. But in this case, Walden trying to repeat that criticism, he, I think, was basically told by some of his colleagues that's not the most intelligent approach to take, because we are, again, proposing cuts to Medicare. We want to greatly restructure the program.
Stephen, what would be the outcome of less domestic spending and less defense spending that's outlined in this budget? What would be cut here?
It's mainly, in Obama's budget, it's mainly what
right.
would be squeezed. You know, as far as things being, you know, the actual details on what's going to look like 8 or 9 or 10 years ago from now, that's sort of, you know, still up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
But basically what happens is Obama wants to replace the sequester, which is, you know, an across-the-board cut that's happening right now, and replace it with, you know, sort of a muddle-along budget where you don't necessarily get big increases each year, but you don't get big cuts either. And so that means, you know, you keep having increases at the NIH for medical research, and you don't have to, you know, have a sequester that says, you got to cut those by 10%. You don't have 10% across the board cuts or larger to the defense budget. Instead, you have maybe more like 2 or 3 or 4% cuts that are phased in, that are more targeted than the sequester. So for the president's budget, it's mainly about replacing the sequester and finding alternative cuts, preferably in the president's view, with longer term cuts that sort of phase in years 7, 8, 9, and 10, when the economy would presumably be stronger than it is today. In fact, the president really is trying to, in his budget at least, is sort of the wish list side of it, still wants more stimulus. He has $166 billion in stimulus-type spending on transportation, on money for teachers, firefighters, a lot of things that he's been trying and failing to get for the last several years, and he's probably going to fail to get again, unless there's some, you know, magic deal out there that the president, if the president were to give up, for instance, his quest for more tax increases, I think there's at least a chance he could get some of these other items done in some kind of mini deal with the Republicans. But that, you know, that remains to be seen. But basically, the president wants more austerity later and more sort of stimulus now. The Republicans want austerity now, austerity
right.
later, austerity in the future. So that, you know, that's sort of a different vision.
Yeah, it's a very different vision.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mark, for the call. Mary in Marshfield. Hi.
Hi. My name is Mary, and I get a little excited when I see the Republicans dig their feet in and try and get Obama to do whatever they want to. I look back at the bill that George W. Bush left us. His war cost us $11.3 trillion, and then right before he left office, he took $7 more billion to bail out the banks. So that's a $12.0 trillion total. And now we're all supposed to bow to the Republicans and do what they want to. And their Republican president, and ours, was very foolish with his money and his spending. They want to hit people's bills for Medicare, for all these other things and destruct those and take taxes on Social Security, which has already been robbed many times. So I really think we ought to get down to the dollars and cents and who took what where. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And Professor Myers.
I happen to personally agree that the deficits that we started to run after 9/11, particularly driven by the tax cuts, weren't the most intelligent policy. I'm not sure I'm willing to blame just Republicans for the situation we're in, and particularly the Great Recession was the product of some very complicated forces, and probably you could identify both Republicans and Democrats as, in some sense, culprits for not adequately regulating financial markets and the housing markets. I think it's more important to look forward and to consider what kind of reasonable policies can help us become a better country and at the same time make us financially sustainable. And I don't think that the sequestration approach has been in any way intelligent. And just to modify the impressions people might have taken away from the previous discussion, the Obama budget would like to reduce the impact of the sequester starting this next fiscal year in FY14, but the sequesters that have been, the cuts that have been imposed for this fiscal year with their associated furloughs and the like, they're going to continue. Although, of course, there have been some cases where Congress has realized that, you know, maybe that really didn't make too much sense to reduce funding for meat inspectors and the like. There was a very interesting report in the Washington Post a couple of days ago by Sarah Cliff, which described how the sequester is leading towards the reduction of necessary drugs for cancer patients. And that's because of this special sequester that we've applied to Medicare. Now, who in his right mind think that's an intelligent way to save money? I think we really need to get far beyond this approach of setting temporary and deadlines for ourselves where we impose idiotic cuts on different programs. Instead, sort through the various programs that we have, some of which are favorites of Republicans, some of which are favorites of Democrats, and really ask ourselves, are they working? Are they really our highest priorities?
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense. Are we going to do that, just that, Stephen, at any point?
Well, you know, I think there's a chance this summer. We have a debt ceiling deadline coming up next month. The Treasury can kind of extend that maybe for another couple of months. So we're going to have a chance in the next few months for the parties to try and hash something out that would deal with the sequester, that would deal with the debt ceiling, that would maybe have some kind of budget compromise that could get appropriations bills moving for the first time in a while. There is at least some chance in the next few months that they could work something out. But, you know, the reason why the sequester is here is because the president wants to use it as a bargaining chip to get Republicans to come to the table on tax increases. That's why it's this indiscriminate plan. I mean, the Republicans offered to the president, well, hey, we'll replace the sequester with, you know, we'll give you the authority to decide to make more intelligent cuts. And the president said, no, I don't want that flexibility. It's supposed to be this awful, horrible sequester so that we come to get to the table and reach an agreement. And the question becomes, if this thing goes on several months and it's going to start having more and more effects, it's going to start hitting people more than it is now, do the Republicans blink or does the White House blink? And that's sort of the game of checkers and chess that's being played right now in Washington, is who's going to blink first. The White House and the president keeps insisting they will not. And, you know, the thing is that what Washington tends to do is kick the can down the road. They're very good at that.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually the one thing that they're actually, they've actually shown, whether it be the fiscal cliff or the debt ceiling showdown or government shutdown showdown a couple of years ago, they are actually very good at cutting deals at the last minute that kick the can down the road. So I wouldn't be surprised if they find a way to delay the sequester or to modify it or to kick the can down the road effectively through the next election if they can't come up with a bigger deal. Now, there is this this point, as the professor noted, the president is wooing dozens of Republican senators who at least seem to be open to the idea of doing something on revenue. That is sort of like the only real game in town right now, is if that bargain can be reached in the Senate. Otherwise, we're looking at muddle through or the White House having a change of heart and willing to negotiate something else.
A couple lines are open if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about the budget this hour of the program. Stephen Dennis, White House correspondent for Congressional Quarterly, is one of our guests, and also Professor Roy Myers, professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org. Or you can always leave some messages for us on our Facebook page. We like to read those. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Steve in Milwaukee, our next caller. Hi, Steve.
Yes, hi, Kathleen. Thanks again for a real quality show. I appreciate hearing your guests. I have a question on Social Security. My understanding, and please correct me if I'm off on this, but my understanding is that Social Security taxes are capped at around $125,000 of income. Am I correct in that assumption?
Professor Myers?
Yeah, for old age, survivor's disability insurance part of the tax, for the Medicare part of the tax, you actually pay a higher amount.
My question with that is, why can't, whose sacred cow is this that we can't raise the income level for taxing on Social Security? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, yeah, that certainly has been one of the proposals that people have made, and I think it's likely going to be on the agenda as we, you know, try and close that financing gap in the future. As Steve mentioned, the change CPI would only do about a quarter of it, and I think if there are going to be additional revenues, that's probably one of the top ones on the list.
Yeah, the reality is Republicans don't, they've all signed pledges. They will never raise taxes. They don't want to break those pledges. The last time the Social Security taxes were raised was, around, I think, 1983, when Ronald Reagan cut a deal with Tip O'Neill. And, you know, it's a much different Republican Party nowadays. And so people might think it's a great idea to raise that cap and to have people, you know, Carmelo Anthony would be paying the cap on his, you know, paying that tax on his entire salary. But there is very little effort in Congress, whether it be Democrats or Republicans, to broach that, and the White House has not pushed it of late. They have, you know, talked about it as something that they could see down the road, but as, you know, as part of some bigger deal on Social Security. But, you know, the reality is it's a non-starter. It's not going to get through this Congress. And instead, we're talking about much smaller things like CPI, which it seems to be about the most, the biggest kind of thing we're going to see out of this Congress anytime soon.
Well, would raising that cap solve the problem?
I think it would come very close, but the problem is you have all kinds of other problems. You have Medicare is a much bigger long-term problem than Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're talking tens of trillions of dollars in unfunded programs, whereas Social Security is, I believe, under $10 trillion in unfunded in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you raise the cap, it would potentially solve the problem for Social Security, but create other problems elsewhere.
Professor Myers?
We did go to that well already from the Affordable Care Act, in that the income cap is off for the Medicare portion of the FICA. And in addition, part of the Affordable Care Act is financed by taxing people on for their Medicare tax regarding unearned income, such as interest, dividends, capital gains. So we've used part of that resource already to help finance the expansion of access under Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment and some emails that are coming in as well. The budget is what we're talking about this hour. And our guests are Professor Roy Myers, Professor, Department of Political Science, University of Maryland, Baltimore Center, Stephen Dennis, White House correspondent for Congressional Quarterly Roll Call. 800-486-8655 is our number, and some lines are open for you right now. They've been rather busy, but they are open now, and we'll continue taking calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our show, this is Jazz Appreciation Month. No better way to appreciate than to listen and talk about jazz. We have all kinds of music we'll be listening to, and our guest will be an American jazz expert who's host of Jazz with Barb Paralocha. It's a nationally syndicated evening jazz show, which we run on our news and classical network, and that's coming up hour number two. All right, let's go to more phone calls. Fred in the Upper Peninsula. Hello, Fred.
Hello, Christy. I got 3 points I want to make. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead, Fred.
Yeah, I got 3 points I want to make.
Yeah, we heard you.
One is about the Social Security money they took out of Social Security back in the 80s to pay off for national debt. And the other 2 points is one about the Medicare and Medicaid. There's two differences there. Medicare, we have to make a monthly payment. It cost me $130 personally every month to have Medicare. Now, people with Medicaid don't cost them nothing. But in February, the president took over so many billions of dollars out of Medicare that we have to make payments on that is in good shape and put it in Obamacare. And Medicaid has not been touched, and they're not going to touch it because that's what all the Mexicans get.
You're right. Professor Myers.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with most of what he said about fund transfers. I mean, the reality is that we have a very expensive set of health care programs in this country, and we also have a lot of health needs as well. And I personally think Affordable Care Act was, on balance, a good law because it expanded access and it has the possibility of putting in place some cost controls if we build on it so that we can start to address the high level of cost growth we have in this country, which is really unaffordable. Part of that issue actually has to do with the incomes of providers. It's one thing that's really not discussed too much in this country, but medical care providers in this country earn fairly large incomes compared to incomes earned by their colleagues in other countries. Now, if you look at the emphasis in the in this budget, the emphasis is typically in the rhetoric on going after providers, not beneficiaries, but there are going to be some increased co-payments here for beneficiaries as well, particularly those at the upper income distribution. The reality is that over the long run, we're going to have to make the system much more efficient than it is, but we're also going to have to reduce the incomes of providers, and beneficiaries are going to have to pay more. I mean, the reason why it's called hard choices, budgeting, that is, That's a good case.
Stephen?
I want to talk a little bit about the transfer from Medicare to Medicaid, because I think that's something that's very poorly understood. If you think about what Medicare and Medicaid and Obamacare, the health care exchanges, more people getting insurance, you think, okay, well, there was $700 and some billion that went from the Medicare program to these other pools and these other programs. But where does that money go? That money goes to the same place. So what does Medicare pay for? It pays for doctors and hospitals and drugs and all those things. Well, the money's still going to end up in those very same doctor's offices, those same hospitals, and in many cases in the drug insurance company, you know, the drug company's books. The difference is right now, if you go to an emergency room, that money, you know, the hospital eats that cost. And that eating of that cost ends up on everybody else's bill. And the reason why the hospitals and the drug companies and all those providers, the doctors, signed on to the bill and endorsed it is because right now they're giving all this a free care away. And so, yes, they're getting their cut under Medicare, but they're going to have 30 million more paying customers. The reality is they're going to actually get a little bit more money overall than they would have if the bill had never passed. So is there a $700 billion cut from Medicare? Yes, but does it really affect a Medicare patient who goes to the hospital? Not that much, because that same hospital might be a little bit more healthy because they're not treating as many people in the emergency room who aren't paying for it. So it's a complicated issue that it doesn't, you know, it's hard to just explain that in a sentence or two.
Yeah. What isn't complicated, and one of the themes of this program, isn't it remarkable, Professor Myers, that we have spent years and years trying to come up with something better? Everybody agreed we had a problem, and we still have this huge problem of why it costs so much money, and it plays into so many of the other issues that we're discussing. We just can't get a handle on it. We just talk about it and talk about it and talk about it, and we still haven't fixed the problem.
Well, I'm not sure we're ever going to fix it, in the sense that as we become richer as a nation, it's understandable to want to buy higher quality health care. We can afford it at some level. But in this market, as in other markets, there are highly entrenched economic interests that are very politically influential. And I think actually we have made significant progress here and there, and that we're just going to have to continue to plug away at it. What kind of dismays me about the gentleman's comment, I understand where he's coming from, because if I don't have a high income and I have to pay Medicare Part B premiums, I'm concerned about them going up. On the other hand, you know, think about what happens when you're relatively poor and you're on Medicare and you need assisted living or you need to go into long-term care, and you spend down your assets to the point where you're eligible for Medicaid. You know, Medicaid is not a very good long-term care program. It costs a tremendous amount of money, and in general, that's a major risk that we have in this country that is not effectively covered by the existing insurance programs. And I think actually one of the things that we're going to need to think about over the next decade is how to restart the experiment that was put in the Affordable Care Act, the so-called CLASS Act, which is a very poorly designed attempt to try and finance long-term care, and come up with something more reasonable. That is, like I said before, instead of just focusing on or overemphasizing how money might have been transferred from one account to another in past years, let's look forward, think about the policy challenges that we face, and think about how we can finance them in an affordable way.
Let's go to, we have a couple emails, but they're really long. So let's go to Linda. We have a minute left. Linda in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The gentleman just said something that was very key. The problem, Kathleen, with why we talk and talk about Medicare and health care and Social Security is we have very deeply entrenched economic interests that don't, that want to eliminate these programs. Senator Cole, I wrote to him 2 years ago. He wrote me a two-page letter. He said Social Security was in fine shape, and the cap on Social Security has been raised almost 40 times since it was started during the 30s. And lifting the cap would solve the problem totally. But Cole said Social Security is in fine shape, at least until 2030, 2040. Lifting the cap, stop it from being a regressive tax on just poor people or moderate income people is the answer.
All right. Thank you, Linda, very much for the call. And on that call, we have to say goodbye. Professor Roy Myers, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Kathleen.
And Stephen Dennis, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Take care.
Thank you. And conversations will continue because we just touched the surface. Obviously, the budget is a big thing, and there are other elements we never even got to. But the question is, will everybody in Washington get to this, or will we muddle along? Roy Myers, professor in the Department of Political Science, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Stephen Dennis, White House correspondent for Congressional Quarterly Roll Call. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to Katie Madsen for on-air production in beautiful downtown Milwaukee. We'll return.